All right. We now have a podcast from Sophia Jacober and John Austin. And the topic is the local fish industry, local fish. So stay tuned to the Andy Zanke Youth Empowerment Program. And after the story, we will talk to Sophia Jacober and John Austin. Thanks for tuning in to Katie and Kay.
It was Christmas morning in sixth grade when my younger brother, Fisher, came running into my room at 5:30 in the morning, yelling at me to come downstairs and see the presents under the tree. I followed him downstairs while pulling on a large hoodie. It was still dark out, but the lights from the tree illuminated the brightly colored packages that had appeared in our living room overnight. The floor was covered with the colorful tissue paper that once wrapped the socks and little chocolates from our stockings. My father handed me a small, narrow package. I opened it slowly. Inside lay a real box of flies and a small blue fly rod. I was overjoyed and couldn't wait for the ice to melt off the Crystal River so I could learn to fish. When the snow finally melted, I grabbed my tackle and ran down to the small hole in the river that meanders past my house. I had grown up watching my dad and grandfather master the art of an angler. They made it look so easy, so I didn't think I would have any trouble laying the small fly over the water. I soon discovered that I was very wrong. It took many attempts, all of which resulted in a caught tree or a very tangled line, before I could get my fly into the water at all. Over the years, I have fallen in love with the art of fly fishing and have continued to strive for the perfect cast that I have seen my father complete so many times before. This type of fishing has always captivated my attention. Whenever I see a fly fisherman wading in the river or on the bank of an alpine lake, I have a deep admiration for their commitment to time spent untangling lines from a nearby tree and learning how to catch a fish with a teeny hook.
Growing up, I lived on Lindenmeyer Lake in Fort Collins, Colorado. Lindenmeyer Lake is a murky lake about 1 mile long and half a mile wide, stocked with tons of largemouth bass. I have been fishing there for as long as I could walk. Every summer, my brother and I would fish almost every day on this lake. We had an old flat-bottom fishing boat that was originally painted a light blue but was repainted army green. In some places, flakes of the green were coming off, and this made the boat look polka-dotted. We would go out in this boat and fish until dark. I have continued to love fishing after moving to Carbondale a few years ago. Now I enjoy fly fishing on the rivers and lakes throughout the Roaring Fork Valley.
My name is Sophia Jacober.
And my name is John Austin. We are seniors at the Colorado Rocky Mountain School, and we are here to address some major issues facing migratory fish populations.
Both of us know the feeling of accomplishment after finally catching a fish and know what it is like to hold one of these animals in our hand. While taking an AP Environmental Science course this last year and watching the dry summer that Colorado faced this past summer, we have come to discover the threats that these fish face. When starting off, we had our mindset that dams were a major issue facing migratory fish populations because they prevent the fish's return to their spawning grounds. Fish travel up the same river they were born in to lay their eggs during spawning, but if a dam blocks the river, less fish are able to return to these areas. Dams also have a negative impact on the surrounding environment because they prevent nutrients from traveling downstream to the river ecosystem below.
We ventured out to the streets of Carbondale, Colorado, which is a small town that is boxed in by two rivers with outstanding fly fishing, hoping to discover the public's understanding on the effect of dams.
My name's John Folkrod from Carbondale. And, well, I think it's tough for fish to get up and down the river, but at the same time, you have, if the dam is for hydroelectricity, you've got some pros and cons there about whether, you know, if we need the electricity versus the fish.
John and most of the other people we spoke to address the fact that it is hard to choose between electricity and fish, because we as humans need to power our rapidly growing population. But it is hard to decide whether we should endanger these native species.
To further investigate the issues of dams and their threat to migratory fish, we interviewed Matt Abusi, a commercial fisherman in Bristol Bay, Alaska. We met Matt and his wife, Robin Colt, the biology and environmental science teacher at Colorado Rocky Mountain School in Carbondale. We interviewed Matt in the library at CRMS during dinner, one of the rare occasions that this space is quiet and empty of students. Matt is in his early 30s with dark brown hair, and when we talked to him, he was sporting a ball cap and a brown t-shirt with a print of a fish, which seemed fitting for the situation. When asked about the issues that dams present to the fishing industry, Matt spoke with great concern for the fish.
The conversation about dams is complex, and it depends which lens you're looking at it through. If you're looking at it through sustainable power production, dams can be quite good. If you're looking at them through the lens of wild fish habitat, they can be quite bad. There's definitely a balance there in the needs of people versus the needs of fish, and so you make compromises. And I think when you start talking about dams, you can't ignore the fact, that we need, our civilization needs dams to some capacity. Very likely, or at least at this point, we need dams. But we probably have too many, and it's possible to improve the system. And I think that's what a lot of people are trying to do, is create a system or an environment where we can do both, is have the benefits of dam-type structures in the way of water retention and power production, et cetera, but also allow for wild species of fish. Fish, specifically salmon, migrate up rivers to spawn. Most salmon are born in freshwater and then travel to saltwater oceans to live out most of their lives and return to the freshwater to spawn the next generation of fish. So, you know, blocking that process in any capacity basically stops the fish migration and stops the population of salmon in that environment from propagating. And wild salmon are remarkably resilient and can return relatively quickly to areas that have been and rivers that have been dammed. But that's not the only consideration in the discussion. People have needs for power and irrigation and river diversion for development, et cetera, et cetera.
Matt addressed the issue that fish face when trying to return to their spawning ground only to find the river blocked by a dam. He brought up the controversy between the need for electricity and the desire to protect fish that the public spoke to earlier. We were eager to learn more about the effect that dams had on migratory fish, so we drove up to the Rudai Reservoir Dam to try out the world-class fly fishing. Below the Rudai Dam is a very popular fishing spot because the shrimp and other small organisms are flushed from the bottom of the reservoir into the stream below. The presence of these aquatic animals in the water attracts fly fishermen from all over who want to test their luck with the trout that feed in the outlet of the dam.
It was a sunny Saturday afternoon as we drove to the dam. The aspens and oak trees were turning brilliant shades of yellow and orange. The good weather seemed to attract the anglers who were lined up along the stream within casting distance of each other. The wind was blowing when we arrived at the base of the dam, presenting an additional challenge for casting as well as collecting audio. The Rudai Reservoir fills the bottom of a green, mountainous valley with miles of water. The setting and access to deep water attracts people from all over who want to drive their boats or enjoy a beautiful day on the lake. Under the dam, the water, trapped by the large red wall, roared from the outlet, causing mist to rain down on the rocks below. The dam towered over the small, clear stream. It is a small structure in comparison to the Hoover Dam, but the reservoir has a large presence in the small Roaring Fork Valley where it is placed. The rivers in the Roaring Fork Valley are filled with rainbow and brook trout. Though we did not catch any on this day, both of us have caught these two types of trout in the past. Personally, brook trout are my favorite, with their bright red stripe on the underbelly and their slimy texture. Rainbow trout also have their beauty, with a colorful stripe running down the entire length of the body from their red gills to their flopping tail.
For a while, we tried our luck, attempting to catch some trout. Proving unsuccessful, we instead decided to talk to some of the fishermen. They all seemed very pleased to share their stories about how they were introduced to fly fishing and what they thought was the main issue facing fish populations.
Unfortunately, the wind was too strong to collect any audio, but most of the anglers believed that the warming of the water temperatures was the main threat to fish populations.
We started this project focusing mainly on the problems that dams present to migratory fish species. We were given a new perspective when speaking to the fishermen about how warming water temperatures affect the fish populations. Matt spoke to the issue. The ocean fishing industry that he partakes in is directly impacted by the warming temperatures because the change of sea level due to global warming changes coastal habitat. This alters the life cycle of fish, such as salmon, that return to their spawning grounds every year. thus impacting the commercial fishing industry that relies on the return of these fish.
Yeah, the water warming changes a lot of things. It changes the contents of the water. It changes where the warm water is at what times. It changes the patterns of ice. Some fish's ability to survive or thrive or spawn in certain areas based on that water temperature.
We found this piece on global warming quite interesting, given the fact that fish are not often discussed when the issue of global warming is brought up. Often it is overlooked. When I and many others think of global warming, we think of the reduced snowfall and the possibility of the polar bear extinction, not fish. Wishing to look further into the topic of warming water temperatures, we spoke to Jeff Dysart, a fly fishing guide and manager of Alpine and Roaring Fork Anglers Fly Shop. Jeff is in his mid-40s with salt and pepper hair and can often be found behind a glass counter full of fly fishing reels and colorful line. We met Jeff in his shop in Carbondale. When we walked in, there were a few older men wandering around in their waders, inquiring about the current fly hatch and looking for the right flies to take to the river. We wandered around the store looking at the different types of flies and tackle. Once the customers left, Jeff pulled up a stool behind the counter and talked to us.
Obviously, dewatering of the systems, the watersheds, is what we've been seeing an issue recurring every 8 years or so. We've been having almost drought conditions every 8 years where water flows are too low, and we're having hot summers, so water temperatures are getting too high, and that stresses the fish out when water temperature is too high, especially when you stress them by catching them. With this being like the third year in the last 15 or so, people are getting more educated about how to treat these fisheries and watersheds when we have low water and warm temperatures. Again, I think that goes back to the education. People are taking better care of the fish.
Jeff brought up the interesting idea that due to the more recent education, fish populations are able to remain stable during a drought year. People are becoming aware of the pressure that fish are under when the water warms and there's less oxygen and food. So fishing becomes prohibited during times of severe stress, such as this past summer, when the water levels were low and warm. This captivated my attention because I had always believed that humans were only bringing harm to the fish populations. It never occurred to me that they might be helping them.
Fish are now able to maintain a stable population during years of drought because of the prevention of fishing at times of high stress with the improved education. Could this same approach be used to help maintain a stable fish population in areas where dams directly affect migratory fish? If people become more aware of the impact that dams present to these native species, it may be possible that people can create a better way for dams and fish to exist together. When we spoke to the people on the streets of Carbondale, many were well-versed in the systems that dams provide for fish, such as ladders that help transport fish up and over the dam, but did not seem to know how reliable and effective those systems were. To inquire about the impact of education, we spoke to my grandfather, Chuck Ogilby. Chuck grew up in Rockford, Illinois, then moved to Colorado where he was introduced to fly fishing. Chuck is in his mid-70s with silver hair and can often be found in a flannel shirt and Carhartts, monitoring the hot springs pool at Avalanche Ranch, maintaining their warmth. Lately, Chuck has been involved with the Wild and Scenic River movement on the Crystal River. The Wild and Scenic River Act protects the rivers from dams and water diversion to keep them free-flowing, protecting the water quality and the natural habitat of the river. Education plays an important role in this act.
We met Chuck in the kitchen of his home in Redstone, Colorado, sitting at the round dining table next to a wood-burning stove and overlooking a horse pasture in the Crystal River. We asked him about his role with the Wild and Scenic Rivers and how he believes education impacts the public. Chuck spoke to the idea that in order for long-time protection of rivers and fish, there must be action from the public.
We're trying now to make the Crystal a wild and scenic river, but it's politically very difficult to do. Basically makes the river into a wilderness area from bank to bank of the river. It gives absolute limited protection to anything beyond the bank, and a lot of people fear that it will encroach on their property rights, which it really won't do. And so that protection, it has three different designations that you can get. You can get it designated for recreation, for wild, and for scenic. So it can be crafted specifically for the needs of the river that you're trying to get it designated to. We're not going to give up. It may fall on the next generation to actually make it happen. If us older guys can't make it happen, but don't give up. What we did on the Crystal, not all me necessarily by any means, it was the people that live on the Crystal, the caucus, which is called SVPA, that really worked hard legally, and Pitkin County, John Ely led the fight to kill the dams that could have been built on the Upper Crystal, one at Placida and one right, basically called the Osgood Reservoir, which was right at the town of Redstone, which would have flooded the entire upper valley. And those it's been probably now 3 years since those have totally gone away, but that was a legal fight that was hard fought and won. And so those dams will never be built on the Crystal. And that's one major step in preserving the Crystal. Now that those dams are gone, the potential for wild and scenic, the door is open. And the Forest Service has classified the Crystal as eligible for wild and scenic designation. So those doors are open, but the valley is mixed, especially up at the upper end of the valley in Marble, are mixed with their feelings about the benefits and federal government interference in the protection of the Crystal. And if we can overcome that and all come together as one valley with some kind of specially crafted plan for making it wild and scenic, we will do that and keep at it until it gets done.
Ever since my first cast of a fly rod,